You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, Governor Evers recently approved new taxes on vaping and e-cigarettes. We'll talk about the details of the plan and the impact it could have on public health. First, more and more people are going beyond cats and dogs when they look for pets and getting exotic reptiles, mammals, and other unusual animal companions. That could be contributing to the rise of invasive species we see around the country. That's according to a new report published last month in the journal Frontiers in Ecology and the Environment. Wisconsin has less restrictive laws for exotic pets than many other states, and some shelters around the state are trying to make sure those pets don't end up in the wild. Jamie Kozlowski runs a unique sanctuary organization for those animals. Jamie's the founder and director of Kingdom Animalia Exotic Animal Rescue in De Pere. Jamie, welcome to Central Time.
Thank you for having me.
Well, how common are exotic pets here in Wisconsin?
Exotic pets and the exotic pet market is actually booming, and it's becoming a lot more frequent in even our immediate area here. Wisconsin is one of the states that has the most relaxed exotic animal laws, and it's starting to become a problem because so many people are getting them. They realize how much work they are. They don't want them anymore. And there's really not a lot of resources or reliable resources. And so people don't know what to do with these, or sometimes they just don't care. And sometimes it's honestly an accident. These animals escape. They get out. It happens to the best of us. And these animals find themselves in unfamiliar territory around people in an area in a state that they're not from. And it can cause a lot of damage to people and the environment and the animals that we have here.
Can you give us a sense of the different types of animals we see being kept as pets and unfortunately released?
I've personally seen coming into my rescue anything from boa constrictors, parrots, African spurred tortoises, ball pythons, red-eared sliders. We've even had alligators come in. Again, people are getting these and they either don't know what they want to do with them when they no longer want them, or they have them outside in enclosures or in fenced in areas. They push fences open and things like that. But that's a lot of them that you're getting. Bearded dragons as well is a big one, because those are the types of animals that you would see at the pet store.
You mentioned the problems that can happen when these animals are released intentionally or unintentionally into the wild. I know some states, especially Florida, you keep hearing stories about these species actually going nuts, really taking over ecosystems. Is this something we worry about in Wisconsin with some species taking root and living here when they probably shouldn't?
It can happen because reptiles are so incredibly resilient. So if enough are released, and let's just say we have a few winters that are really mild, or they happen to find some place where they can shelter down, absolutely we could start to see problems with some of these animals. And if they don't become problems being invasive, the animal's likely going to die if it's released. It's not going to be able to find the right shelter and the food that it would normally find in nature. Heaven forbid it should hurt somebody while it's out and about as well.
Talking to Jamie Kozlowski, founder and director of the Kingdom Animalia Exotic Animal Rescue. Jamie, can you tell us about your organization and how you are trying to help solve this problem?
Absolutely. Kingdom Animalia Exotic Animal Rescue has been a dream of mine since I was very young, and our main goal is to educate. We want to make sure that we're teaching people, if you are going to get these animals, this is what you can expect. These are the types of things that you can do in your home to make this doable. And then if you no longer want them, here are some things that you can do with that animal that are proper. We talk about conservation and why these animals are important in nature, like the pollinators, which again is even really important to us here in our communities. And then we also talk about just some of the issues with overbreeding and what can happen when things, go south in terms of release.
So if I was thinking about getting some kind of exotic animal in my house, and I'm not, but if I was, I could give you a call and say, hey, I'm thinking of getting X. What should I think about before I make that decision and go ahead with it?
Absolutely. We're one of the resources that we have in the state. There are also other reptile groups, clubs, and shelters and rescues that you can contact, different sanctuaries. And, if one of us can't help you, absolutely, we can refer you to someone else. We, as an organization, not only do we focus on the education, but we also take in exotic animals. We also rehome the ones that are proper to be in a home, more of the pet store animals. And then if there's an animal, like, for example, we're the only rescue in the whole state who's taking in unwanted pet foxes, which are becoming more prevalent, especially with social media, glorifying them as pets and making them look cute when they spend the rest of the afternoon destroying everything you own. that's a problem because when we're taking them in, then it's our job to go back and make sure that we're trying to correct those things. And we're actually working with some legislation changes right now, making sure that we correct that. But when we have an animal like that, we'll keep it on site. We'll educate with it. We'll talk about the reality of some of these situations. And then we'll also potentially look for other facilities that would be able to utilize those for the benefit of the long-term goal for these animals, which is to, if they're going to be kept, properly keep them, and then make sure that when there are releases and people irresponsibly keeping them, that we make sure we get a handle on that and that people have some accountability.
I could see somebody saying, okay, I've got a fox. There are foxes in Wisconsin. It's no big deal to release this fox into the wild. What's wrong with that?
What's wrong with that is a lot of the foxes that you will see coming out of fox farms, of which Wisconsin has 4 running right now, they are oftentimes mixes between other things. They're not natural native foxes. But the other thing is that foxes, they're cautious, but they're inquisitive and curious. And they might come up to my dog, Andre, because they love him. But let's just say they're up north and they run into a bear dog or something like that where it's not a friendly dog. Or let's just say they're used to people. They're going to run up to your child and want to play with them, and you're going to think it has rabies and it's sick and shoot it. They don't know what a car is. And so these animals are extremely confused when they get outside of the fence, and they are not necessarily equipped to take care of themselves. And heaven forbid they have some kind of a disease or worms or anything like that, where it would spread to our native animals here. And again, wreak havoc on the environment and the animals that we currently have.
I want to hear, Jamie, some more of your story. You mentioned that this has been, having a shelter like this, a rescue like this, has been a dream of yours since being a kid. How did you get there?
Oh my goodness. So we took a family trip to Florida when I was little, and for the first time I saw all these little lizards running around and I was just hooked. And I would read about them and read about them in my spare time. And eventually everyone was seeing I was savvy with them. And so I started to kind of take them in when people didn't want them. And because I was getting so many of them, I ended up having to start rehoming, which was the birth of my adoption program. Then because so many of them coming in were sick and injured due to improper care, people were not reading enough about them, and the pet stores weren't quite getting the information out that was needed, I was seeing behavior issues and calcium deficiencies, broken bones, malnourishment, and all these things that we don't have to put these animals through. And so I started educating. And in 2006, that became my absolute goal and mission, was to educate, educate. So because I chose to do this then full time, after going to UWGB, studying biology, I worked a little bit with animal control with Green Bay PD. I was an intern at the new zoo, and then I was helping the wildlife sanctuary in Green Bay for the last 13 years as well to take in their exotics that get brought in there. So lots of different experiences brought me to this. So we decided then, 2012 we incorporated, 2013 we became a 501c3 nonprofit, 2014 we got our first public building. We're currently operating in Suring, but in the next year and a half, we're hoping to have our funding in line so that we can create and build our brand new and permanent facility that will be community-based, lots of education, as well as lifelike enclosures for these animals.
I want to end with some messages for different groups of people. First, what would you say to someone who's thinking about getting some kind of exotic pet? What kind of things should they be thinking about before they make that move?
Some of the things that, when I'm talking to children, I talk to them about some of the sacrifices that they would have to make in their homes to have these. If you want a tortoise that eats grass all year, well, in the wintertime when they need grass, you're going to have to empty out all your popsicles and your frozen pizzas and your venison because you need space for your frozen grass. Other things is, how big is the animal going to get? How long is it going to live? And can you accommodate their diet? If any of those don't line up, don't even consider it, because you're just setting yourself up for failure and the animal up for failure. Definitely talking to and try volunteering places, because volunteering someplace might get you to see what it's actually like. And we absolutely welcome people to, you know, come meet our foxes. If you think you want to get a fox, come clean with us for a day. See what it's really smelling like. See what they're really like. See what they do to the yard. Because if you see that and you think, well, I don't want my house smelling like this, it smells like a skunk. Absolutely. You know, and maybe that'll get people to reconsider. So we work with interns, volunteers. And then once we get back to the general Green Bay area again, we will be opening it up for employment as well.
And finally, for someone who already has that exotic pet and realizes they can't meet its needs anymore, what would you say to them?
There are so many places. Absolutely, please do not release. Not only will the animal likely die, but if it doesn't and becomes invasive, or if it hurt somebody, that was all something that you could have avoided. When you go to surrender an animal someplace, you know, it's for the most part, you know, depending on what group you go to, non-judgmental. We want to be there. We're there because we want to help. We're not there to sit and judge you and point fingers and yell at you. We're there to educate. So even in a bad situation, when we can take that and turn it into a learning experience, not only for them, but for everybody, that's actually a positive thing that came out of that then.
Jamie, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thank you so much for having me.
That was Jamie Kozlowski, founder and director of the Kingdom Animalia Exotic Animal Rescue. She joined us from our studio in Green Bay. We talked to her about people keeping wild or exotic animals as pets and what can happen if those owners release those pets in the wild. Coming up, we'll take a closer look at a new Wisconsin law that taxes e-cigarettes and vaping products and find out how it compares to the approach other states are taking. Stay with us here on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, a resolution that condemns several of President Trump's recent tweets as being racist passed the U.S. House yesterday. We'll check in on that story and others during our look at the week in Washington. First, as of next October, e-cigarettes and vaping products will see new taxes here in Wisconsin. It'll be the first time e-cigarettes are subject to anything more than the state sales tax, but the debate over how heavily to tax them isn't over. Mark Sommerhauser is a communications director for the Wisconsin Policy Forum, and Will Henkes is a graduate student at the La Follette School of Public Affairs at UW-Madison and an intern at the Wisconsin Policy Forum. They wrote a report on e-cigarettes. Mark, thanks for being with us.
It's great to be with you.
And Will, welcome to the show.
Thank you.
Mark, can you walk us through what this change to the tax laws in the new state budget does when it comes to e-cigarettes, these vaping products?
Yeah, so Wisconsin's new tax on e-cigarette products is pretty straightforward. Effective here in October, there's going to be a tax of 5 cents per milliliter on e-cigarette or vaping fluid that's sold here in the state. So that's pretty much it. Some other states are taking a lot more complex approaches to taxing this stuff. Wisconsin's, for now, it's pretty simple.
Simple. And how does it compare in terms of the amount we're taxing these products compared to what we see in other states so far?
Yeah, so Wisconsin's tax rate is tied for the lowest of any of the at least 20 states that we could find that tax e-cigarette products. That 5 cent per milliliter, there are four other states that also tax at that rate, and then the remaining states go up from there.
And Will, let's define these products now. These are, I think the word is non-combustible, you never flip a lighter or anything, nicotine products, right?
Yeah, so essentially it's anything that heats up a liquid that then you inhale the aerosol, and it is, right, referred to as non-combustible.
And you looked into some of the public health arguments about this, and I've talked to a lot of public health people. There's a good news, bad news story that seems to be emerging here. What's the latest that you're seeing?
Yeah, absolutely. So I think it really comes down to the trade-off between the fact that they are less dangerous for you than traditional combustible cigarettes, but at the same time, they're way more attractive to children. So you look at, in Wisconsin, the rate of high school e-cigarette use has really skyrocketed over the past 4 years. It's at roughly 20% now.
And Mark, what did the original proposal from Governor Evers look like in the budget he submitted to the legislature?
Quite a bit different than the one he signed. Yeah, the governor proposed to extend to e-cigarette products an existing tax that the state already has on non-cigarette tobacco products like cigars and pipe tobacco, and that's a 71% tax. So quite a bit higher than the 5 cent per milliliter tax that he ultimately signed.
I've heard public health officials will say higher taxes help deter something like smoking or other unhealthy activities. Is that part of the thinking as you see it in what goes into deciding how much to tax a product like e-cigarettes?
Yeah, absolutely. So taxation is one of the most proven to be effective methods of reducing cigarette use. And the evidence shows that that carries over to e-cigarettes as well. And then additionally, youth are much more price responsive than adults to changes in cigarette and e-cigarette prices.
An interesting thing in your piece, though, is that, we have this tobacco tax in Wisconsin. Mm-hmm. We've been relying on that revenue actually more so than many other states. So it's good news when tobacco use goes down, but there's a budget hit when that happens, you write.
Yeah, exactly. So that's one of the trade-offs of relying on, you know, cigarette tax revenue is you're generating revenue from this product that you're also trying to discourage the use of. So, you know, if you're successful in discouraging the youth, your revenue is naturally going to fall.
We're talking about taxes on e-cigarettes and vaping products in the new state budget. We have Mark Sommerhauser with us from the Wisconsin Policy Forum, and Will Hankus, also an intern of the Wisconsin Policy Forum with La Follette School of Public Affairs at UW-Madison. They wrote a recent report on these changes to taxes. When we have these sin taxes, whether we're talking about tobacco or the vaping products, is this going into the general budget, Mark, or is this like a separate thing where it's earmarked for health uses?
Right. So it does go into the general fund. And, you know, as we cover in our report, I mean, cigarette tax revenue is a sizable amount of money within the state's general fund budget. At its peak, it was more than $600 million per year. It's now down, I think, around 530 some million per year. So this is a sizable stream of revenue into the state budget.
We have this state budget in place. It has these taxes now on e-cigarettes products. I guess I should say, are we taxing the devices here or the I've never used these things, but there's devices, right? And there's the liquid you put into them and ignite. What are we taxing?
And in some cases, they're sold together, so that makes it a little more complicated, whereas in some cases, they're sold separately. Wisconsin's tax, again, is more narrow in that it only taxes the fluid.
Okay.
And again, in some cases, they are sold together. So in those cases, it's only the fluid then that's subject to Wisconsin's tax. Other states are doing it differently, though, and are taxing the devices as well.
So. Is this debate done now that this budget has passed, or do you see it likely to be revisited over time?
Yeah, I don't see any way that this goes away anytime soon. You know, the factors that are kind of, I think, cause policymakers to take up this issue in the first place, such as the increasing usage, especially among teens, that trend only appears to be continuing. Obviously, with Wisconsin adopting a tax that's at the low end of where some states are, we already saw some public health groups weighing in. You know, prior to the governor's signature of the budget, you know, saying this tax is too low, that we need a higher tax to be more effective in deterring, especially young people from consuming these products. So it seems like this debate is going to continue.
Will, I see ads for vaping supplies all over the place. Lots and lots of storefronts have them. Are we seeing pushback to the idea of taxes from the industry? And if so, what kind of arguments are they making to the state?
Yeah, absolutely. So Evers' original proposal would have been a 71% inventory tax, and there was a ton of pushback there. A lot of store owners essentially arguing that they wouldn't be able to continue to operate. And I think really what the argument is from the industry is that vaping is, you know, proven to be better for your health than smoking combustible cigarettes. So they're saying, look, this is a method for quitting smoking. It's preferable to smoking. I think the evidence on whether it's a good smoking cessation method, the jury's still out there. But
and Mark, we talked about a lot of things over the course of the state budget here on Wisconsin Public Radio. Education, prisons, roads, and so on. It seems like this was a little more under the radar in this vast budget document.
We felt the same way. It was one of those things that maybe didn't get as much attention. I think a lot of people who were kind of watching the state budget didn't know how the legislature was going to respond to the governor's proposal. Of course, we ultimately saw that they were willing to accept the new tax, but at a much lower rate, of course, than what the governor proposed. But yeah, I think that's fair to say that this is an item that people are kind of taking a closer look at now that the budget is signed.
Is this something, Mark, that broke down as a Democrat-Republican thing?
I think to some extent, I think, at least to some extent, we saw some other Democrats kind of lining up behind the governor's proposal and the Republican leadership of the Joint Finance Committee, which was kind of where the proposal that was ultimately adopted emerged from. You know, they were the ones to propose the 5 cent per milliliter rate. Typically, though, as you look across the country at how this debate has played out, it has not always broken cleanly on partisan lines. There have been some examples of both parties kind of being you know, not taking uniform positions in a partisan way on this.
Well, as you mentioned, this is in the course of human history, a pretty new product. We don't know as much as we'd like to about the health outcomes. From the perspective of public health and public policy, what are the kind of questions that you think still need to be answered as lawmakers look at setting policy?
Yeah, I think one question that really needs to be answered is the long-term health effects. We know there's significant evidence that they're better for you than traditional cigarettes, but, you know, that's a pretty low bar. So I think that's one question that needs to be answered. I think another is how effective they actually are in helping people quit smoking. And then the third question I think that really needs to be answered is, do they lead to, you know, youth switching to traditional combustible cigarettes?
Now, for the long-term impacts, I guess we're going to have to wait 20, 30 years for studies to actually be able to tackle that. For those other two points you mentioned, do they work for smoking cessation? How much do they get kids to use nicotine? Is there research that is being done? Are people out there looking at this right now?
Oh, yeah. There are tons of new studies popping up. And, you know, the jury's still out, I think, on the smoking cessation effectiveness. It's not approved by the FDA as a smoking cessation method.
Mark, as we watch this issue now, as you mentioned, the budget isn't the be-all, end-all of our policy on e-cigarettes in Wisconsin. What kind of policy issues are you looking at coming up, maybe as separate items in the legislature in the future or 2 years in the next budget?
Well, yeah, I would say probably the biggest one that comes to mind immediately is there is some debate both nationally and at the state level about raising the smoking and tobacco buying age from 18 to 21. And that's something that, you know, potentially then would be applied to e-cigarettes as well as traditional cigarettes. That's probably the biggest example of a, you know, sort of non-budgetary, more policy type of proposal that, you know, a lot of anti-tobacco and anti-smoking advocates are really lining up behind. And, you know, I would anticipate, particularly with the rising consumption that we're seeing of e-cigarettes among teenagers, among high schoolers, that's probably something that's going to get a lot of attention.
And as you were suggesting earlier, I think the tax debate may come back to Wisconsin as to how much e-cigarettes and the fluid could be taxed for.
Yeah, that's very possible.
We'll leave it there for now. Mark, thanks a lot for coming up today.
Yeah, thank you for having me.
And Will, thanks for sharing your research with us.
Thank you.
We're talking to Mark Sommerhauser, Communications Director for the Wisconsin Policy Forum, and Will Hankus, graduate student at the La Follette School of Public Affairs at UW-Madison. He co-wrote a report with Mark on e-cigarettes and taxation here in Wisconsin. Coming up after the news, the U.S. House voted to officially condemn President Trump's tweets aimed at four first-term congresswomen. They condemned them as racist. We'll look at that story and more in our weekly roundup of national politics. I'm Rob Ferret. Stick around. There's more to come on Central Time here on the Ideas Network. It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. You're with us here on the Ideas Network. Coming up, much of Wisconsin is dealing with hot temperatures today, and it's expected to get worse by the end of the week. A meteorologist tells us how long the hot weather could last. First, it's time for a look at the week in Washington. Former House Speaker Paul Ryan is talking more about his time working with President Trump. White House advisor Kellyanne Conway is defying a subpoena to testify in front of Congress. And we're seeing more reaction from lawmakers to President Trump's tweets aimed at four first-term congresswomen. Yesterday, the House passed a non-binding resolution to condemn the president's statements. You can join in at 800-642-1234. What do you make of the House vote to condemn the president's tweets? Should they be doing more, less? Do you want to hear more Republicans speaking out against the president's statements? Do you think this is a distraction from other big issues Congress is working on? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or email ideas@wpr.org. Scott Wong is a senior staff writer at The Hill. Scott, welcome back to Central Time.
Hey, Rob. Good to be back with you.
Well, all the Democrats in the House, I believe, along with a few Republicans, voted in support of this resolution condemning the president's tweets. Can you give us more of a sense of what that resolution says and does?
Well, it doesn't do much. It's mostly symbolic. It simply condemns the president for what Democrats and a handful of Republicans said were racist tweets. These were tweets, if you remember, that the president said about the four freshmen lawmakers of color, Democrats, including Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez and Rashida Tlaib of Michigan, as well as Ilhan Omar of Minnesota. And the president said that, tweeted that they should go back to their own countries and try to resolve problems there. Of course, all four of those women are American. U.S. citizens, as is required to serve in Congress, and three of them were born in the United States. Ilhan Omar was a refugee from Somalia and went through the proper channels to become a U.S. citizen. So Nancy Pelosi was under incredible amount of pressure to do something, and the solution that they found was to vote on, very quickly it happened, vote on a resolution condemning President Trump's words.
There was a lot of back and forth on the House floor leading up to the vote. Here's a bit of what Speaker Nancy Pelosi had to say.
Every single member of this institution, Democratic and Republican, should join us in condemning the president's racist tweets. To do anything less would be a shocking rejection of our values and a shameful abdication of our oath of office to protect the American people.
Right after that remark, there was some procedural chaos in the House based on what you could say on the floor of the House about the president. This gets a little detailed here, but can you tell us what happened there, Scott?
Yeah, just generally, Republicans objected to Nancy Pelosi calling the president's tweets racist in her remarks on the floor. There are House rules that bar lawmakers from criticizing other lawmakers and criticizing the president of the United States or attacking them in a personal way. The parliamentarian ruled that it did in fact violate the House rules, and because Democrats control the majority and have more members in the House than Republicans, they voted to overrule the parliamentarian's decision, and so her words were allowed to remain. And so just a little bit of back and forth between the two parties, but in the end, obviously just a very, very tough week for the House of Representatives.
The politics of this, Scott, some people, I think including the president himself, had said this is ultimately good for President Trump. It focuses attention on what he says are more extreme members of the Democratic Party. Some people saying this is bad for President Trump because you don't see this kind of thing happen very often. What's some of what you've been hearing about the political fallout of this back and forth?
Yeah, it's unclear to me whether this is good or bad for the president. I guess you could argue that it does fire up his base, but obviously, you know, there are a lot of Republicans who have come forward publicly, including Mike Turner of Ohio, Fred Upton, the former energy chairman from Michigan, who have said that, you know, these were flat-out racist comments that the president has made. This is a long-standing racist trope that we've seen throughout U.S. history, and it has no place in American political discourse, let alone from the president of the United States.
Talking to Scott Wong, senior staff writer at The Hill, looking at some of the latest news in the nation's capital. Let's go to your calls now on this congressional resolution condemning the president's tweets at 800-642-1234. Scott joins us in Portage. Scott, hi.
Hi, how you doing today?
Good. What do you think, Scott?
It seems like Omar and the girls, they're always anti-Jewish and anti-America. And nobody really, it never gets a lot of attention, but the minute that the president slips up, all of a sudden it's impeachment. It just seems it's a little heavy-sided to me.
Scott, thanks for the call. Of course, some of Ilhan Omar's comments, Scott Wong, did get a lot of attention, including from fellow Democrats in Congress. What have we seen there?
Well, that's right. Earlier this year, Ilhan Omar's very critical comments about the state of Israel was condemned by almost all Democrats across the board, and really sowed a lot of divisions in the party that are still apparent even today. So what I think President Trump's tweets did was, for a brief moment, unify these sort of warring factions, the progressives and the moderates that we've seen over the last few months and several weeks, and unify them for a brief moment. I do think simmering under it all is still these tensions between the two wings of the Democratic Party, and we're going to see numerous more fights play out in the coming days. Tomorrow, they're going to be taking up a minimum wage bill, which is, again, driving a wedge between the progressives and the moderates in the party.
Scott, thanks for calling in. We'll go now to Tom in Madison. Tom, hi.
Yes, I was just reading an article this morning where saying that someone should go back to their place of origin is by definition a racist statement, and it was in a anti-discrimination federal law. I think the biggest embarrassment to Wisconsin was Sean Duffy, who was described as having a meltdown on the floor of Congress, saying that the women were obvious. It was obvious who they were. They did not love America. And also they wanted to replace capitalism with socialism. And these are just all downright lies.
Tom, thanks for the call. Yeah, Sean Duffy of Wisconsin. His speech got a lot of attention on this. Was there a lot of impassioned talk from both sides leading up and, I guess, following this vote, Scott?
Yeah, I would say so. I mean, you know, we're talking about, and I think it served the president's purpose. I mean, the president, has made, Democrats have been fighting with themselves up until this point about a range of issues. And the president saw an opening and took it. And, it seems like it has reinvigorated Republicans. They see Democrats as overstepping in this regard. Democrats believe that they are in the right here. So it's really unprecedented, some of the words that are being said in press conferences and on the House floor and, of course, by the President of the United States.
On a related note, you were talking about that internal Democratic feud. Another one you've been following, House Democratic Caucus Chair Hakeem Jeffries and the Chief of Staff for Congresswoman Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez. What happened there?
Well, this again all stems back to sort of the infighting that we've seen between progressives and moderates in the Democratic Party, going back a couple weeks to the border aid bill, where progressives wanted a much more liberal bill. Moderates sided with the United States Senate and were able to push through a more moderate bill. That triggered a round of recriminations from progressives. A number of them had called, specifically Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez's chief of staff had referred to other moderate Democrats as segregationists. And in fact, one moderate Democrat woman, Charisse Davids, as a racist, which we've never seen before a chief of staff level those types of accusations against lawmakers of their own party. And that just has created so much bad blood that issue continues to boil over. And so the House Democrats' official Twitter, and all these problems sort of relate back to Twitter, but the House Democrats' official Twitter tweeted back at AOC's chief of staff that he was out of place and that he should not be talking about other members in that fashion. And so you have sort of a war of words happening between the leadership and between AOC. And it's a very hard story to follow, but it has gone off in a number of different directions. And, the bottom line is that Democrats are all pointing fingers at each other and saying awful things about each other and have really been divided over these last few weeks, save for this moment where President Trump interjected himself into the conversation and briefly has unified Democrats.
Let's bring on one more caller. Carol is on the line in Milwaukee. Carol, hi.
Hi. Can I say my opinion?
Yes, please do.
I think the Democrats are reacting just the way Trump wants them to, by worrying and obsessing about all of this, and the news media goes along with it. A lot of obsession, and the way it should have been answered was, yes, these women would be glad to go back to their countries and help them, but Trump should go back to his country and of origin and follow their good example about health care and about global warming, because those countries from Europe could give him a good lesson.
Carol, thanks for the call. The idea that this is a distraction, Scott, that Democrats and the media are chasing too much. What do you think?
Well, it has been a distraction. I mean, when we're talking about racism and going back to your own country, things like that, we are not talking about important issues like health care and you know, the minimum wage vote coming up and reducing drug prices. It has become a distraction. It's also driven a wedge between, I think, Trump and Democrats even further as they try to negotiate some bipartisan, you know, bipartisan issues. And so right now there's talks about a 2-year budget deal. There's talks about lowering prescription drug prices. But it's made those negotiations obviously much tougher.
We're talking to Scott Wong, senior staff writer at The Hill, looking at some of the top political news stories of the week. Coming up, Paul Ryan speaks out on his time as House Speaker while President Trump was President Trump. Also, the latest efforts to start an impeachment hearing. Call 800-642-1234 if you have thoughts on either of those. We'll pick up the conversation coming up on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret. We continue our talk with Scott Wong from The Hill, looking at some of the top news of the week in Washington. Scott, you were on the Paul Ryan beat for quite a while he was House Speaker. He was interviewed as part of a new book about the changes we've seen in the Republican Party by, I think, Tim Alberta. His comments about President Trump, a bit different than what we've heard before. What jumped out to you?
I mean, these were the most forceful comments we've heard Paul Ryan give about President Trump you know, in years, probably since before President Trump became president. And so he feels, the speaker, former speaker, feels liberated and to speak his mind finally after all this time. And I think, you know, he said, I mean, you know, he said things like, you know, the president should not call a woman a horse face. He should not cheat on his wife. It was sort of just the speaker unloading on the president, unlike we've seen before. And it seems like, you know, the speaker made a decision at the time the president got elected that he would hold off on his criticisms and work with him. And that was because he saw himself as one of the adults in the room that could try to, you know, shape the president in the best way he could. But now that he's out of that office, he is really speaking his mind.
Have we heard any response from the president yet to what's been revealed from this book that Paul Ryan said?
Well, yeah, the president never lets anyone throw a punch at him without hitting back. And the president was right back on Twitter, tweeting at the speaker, calling him a weak and ineffectual leader and, you know, the worst speaker in history. So that was to be expected. I think Speaker Ryan expected the president was going to hit back. But there had been sort of this truce over those 2 years when they were serving together. They were able to push through tax reform. And I think Speaker Ryan saw the president as the vehicle that he could move tax reform through, you know, through the Congress and to the president's desk. But also, you know, realized that he saw himself as sort of one of the last lines of defense, you know, against a very unpredictable president, him and Chief of Staff John Kelly and Defense Secretary Jim Mattis. Now, none of those people are in the administration or in the Congress. And so Trump has replaced a lot of those people with acting officials, which is causing some real concern on the part of people like Speaker Ryan.
It seems like an ongoing trend where members of Congress or their staffers in the Republican Party off the record raise concerns about President Trump or are said to have said things about President Trump on the record, not so much until they leave office, as we've seen from Paul Ryan. Is that a trend you've seen?
That's exactly right, because people have seen what happens to the Republican lawmakers who speak out against the president. They end up having a very short political career, like Senator Jeff Flake of Arizona, like Mark Sanford of South Carolina. And the latest example, of course, is Justin Amash, the former Republican turned independent from Michigan, who some people think may jump into a presidential race against President Trump, but he has yet to make a decision.
Talking about some of the top news in Washington this week with Scott Wong from The Hill. Scott, we're watching for an impeachment proceeding vote in the U.S. House. One representative saying he's bringing it up, forcing a vote. We're expecting that. It looks like the latest news is early this evening. What's going on here?
Yeah, that vote is supposed to happen any minute now. It is Congressman Al Green, a very progressive congressman from Texas, He has forced a vote on articles of impeachment against President Trump for later today. This is primarily rooted in the president's tweets about the four minority congresswomen that many deem racist. And Al Green has made his articles of impeachment much more about the president who accusing him of inflaming racial tensions, rather than some of the other articles that we've seen from other lawmakers that have to do more with Russia and obstruction of justice. And so leadership, Nancy Pelosi is not a fan of this. This is not the strategy she wants to go down. And so what they probably will do is just vote to table the articles of impeachment, and that would dispense of the issue, but it would get a lot of people on the record.
Let's bring on a caller on this. Justin is with us in Appleton. Justin, hi.
Hi there. How's it going today?
Good. What do you think?
I think that all this impeachment talk is important because we can look back at President Nixon, and he was impeached, and they talked about impeachment with him. And there was a reason for impeachment. So I think if we would like to see Donald Trump impeached today, we would have to have him actually commit something to be impeachable about. And he hasn't done that, as far as we're concerned. So I think we're going to need to wait for him to make some mistakes or something.
Justin, thanks for the call. And there's argument, Scott, over what exactly constitutes grounds for impeachment.
Well, that's right. And a lot of lawmakers, a lot of Democrats want to wait till next week when Robert Mueller, the special counsel, will be testifying before Congress for the first time since he released his Mueller report on Russian interference and conspiracy and potential obstruction of justice by the president. And so I think, some people say there could be some new revelations. Others are saying, well, he's simply going to regurgitate what he wrote in his report. But a lot of people want to wait and see what Mueller has to say before jumping to that step of impeachment.
Thanks for that call, Justin. Before we wrap up, Scott, Kellyanne Conway, White House advisor, refused to comply with congressional subpoena to testify before the House Oversight Committee. Why was she being subpoenaed?
Democrats had accused her of violating the Hatch Act, which prohibits government officials from engaging in campaign work. And so they said in numerous interviews that she had talked about the 2020 campaign and talked about other elections. So this is a trend of Trump administration officials and White House officials saying that just not honoring the subpoenas from Democrats. We've seen it with most of the cabinet officials, including AG Bill Barr and Wilbur Ross in a separate case involving the 2020 census. Later today, as part of this vote series, the House Democrats will also vote to hold those two cabinet members in contempt of Congress for failing to agree to subpoenas. And so this is an ongoing fight between the executive branch and the legislative branch.
And the White House claiming executive privilege here, but Congress saying, hold on, this isn't about the advice Kellyanne Conway may have given to the president. This is about the violations of the Hatch Act. Probably going to end up in the courts.
Yeah, most of these cases are ending up in the courts, and you know, we've seen rulings on both sides, some in favor of the House Democrats, others in favor of President Trump and the White House. And so a lot of these things are still being worked out through the courts, but this fight is long from over.
Scott, thanks a lot for joining us again today.
Thanks a lot. Take care.
That's Scott Wong, senior staff writer for The Hill. He was with us for a weekly look at some of the week's big stories in national politics. Another big national political story out this week, the latest numbers on the federal budget deficit. We'll be talking about that tomorrow on Central Time. Tune into that at 4:30. Also, we were talking about Robert Mueller testifying before Congress. He was scheduled to do that this week. Now it's looking like it's next week. We will be planning to bring you NPR live coverage of Robert Mueller testifying before Congress. Watch for listings and announcements as we get the details on that. And of course, you can always react to what you hear on these conversations. Tweet us at Central Time WPR. It's National Hot Dog Day. Some restaurants are apparently giving away free hot dogs. That got a lot of us here talking about condiments and what you put on a hot dog. Judith Sears Poisson is in the studio with me. Now, the thing about hot dogs is the hot dog's the least important part of the equation. It's a vehicle, I think, for condiments.
It is a vehicle for condiments and other accoutrements, if one wants to say.
I don't.
But a really good hot dog, like a grilled hot dog, can really push it over the edge.
I feel like it's not as important to have a good hot dog as it is to have like a good brat. Like you really taste
okay,
the brat. The
I can
hot
go
dog
with that.
Gets
I
buried.
Can go with that.
Okay, all that said, what are some of your favorite hot dog condiment combos?
So I have to say I am a huge fan of the traditional Chicago style hot dog. Mm-hmm. And of course, the most important thing is what's not on that, no ketchup. Mm-hmm. So that's, you've got your yellow mustard, also sport peppers, you know, pickle, all that good stuff, celery salt, and a poppy seed bun is very important.
The celery salt is awesome and doesn't have to have that radioactive glowing relish.
The relish, yeah. So, yeah. And also a beef hot dog. I know you said it doesn't really matter, but an all beef hot dog. I have to say the sport peppers, I could put that on anything and enjoy it.
I love just mustard. I love mustard and sauerkraut. And I grew up in Michigan where for some reason we had the Coney dog, yes, which is a chili sauce, onions, and mustard. Been a while, but it's pretty good when you have it.
I had a hot dog just last night that had kimchi on it. Ooh. And fried shallots, cream cheese, a mayo mix. Delish.
I believe I saw a picture of that, yes, very hot dog. This is Central Time on the Ideas Network.